Greetings, SunSounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, SunSounds of Arizona volunteer reader Candy Lewis, and her sidekick, Bullet Lewis. And as we have not received the new issue yet for Science of Mind, we'll dive right into some selections from the Daily Word, and all on the theme of gathering together for Thanksgiving this week. Gathering. I gather with others and feel close to God, to Spirit, to the universe. There are many ways to share the energy of connection with friends and family, whether we communicate by phone, in writing, or on social media. I treasure our connections and the opportunity to be in touch. Gathering in person is perhaps my favorite kind of connection. Just being in the presence of those who are special to me makes my heart glad. Sharing smiles and hugs and spending unhurried time together, sharing stories, is a gift unlike any other. No matter how I gather with my friends and loved ones, I'm grateful God, Spirit, the universe, is with us as the love and joy in our hearts. When it is time for us to part company, I pray we carry that love and joy for the days and years ahead. Time together is a gift, one for which I am so very grateful. Thankful. I am thankful for my many blessings. I count my blessings every day, from the smallest gifts to the ones that make my heart sing. I value them all and appreciate the uniqueness of each one. I am grateful for my family and friends, for people who support me no matter what. I appreciate my environment, the beauty of the dawning sun, the breeze on my face, the birds that sing outside my window. As I add to my gratitude list, my heart expands. Giving thanks opens the way to abundant blessings of healing, prosperity, and harmony. As I think of my blessings and give thanks for them, I deepen in joy and appreciation for my life. The bounty and beauty of the world around me magnify and multiply blessing by blessing. I am grateful. And I wish you all a beautiful Thanksgiving season, whether you're gathered with large groups of family and friends, or small groups, or even spending it by yourself. May you find much to be grateful for, and may you be in peace and feel love for yourself and others and for our world that so needs it at this time. We turn now to Mark Nepo's The Book of Awakening, Having the Life You Want by Being Present to the Life You Have, and we'll share a couple of selections from him today. As far as we can manage, wherever we stop is the summit. I was climbing Trail Ridge Road through the Rocky Mountains, determined to make the Continental Divide, when two sharp feelings pierced me almost at once. I, who have never had any trouble with heights, felt rushes of fear as I drove on narrow stretches 12,000 feet up. I was also filled with the irrevocable truth that everything there is wherever we are. This all made me stop and walk the tundra above the tree line. There, I was overcome with the sudden truth that I could go no further and that I had no need to go any farther. Can it be that this journey through the mountains mirrors the journey through our lives? Is our suffering like the dizzying, gut-wrenching narrow passes through these ancient rocks? Do we simply move on until we can't, and in accepting our humanity, does the peak come to us? What an unlikely truth. I traveled as far as I could manage, and there, on the bare scalp of the earth, I realized that where I can go no further is my destination. This is the wearing of heart that no one can escape. Despite all our noble efforts to reach some treasured peak, be it a dream of wealth or love, we carry the summit within. And it is always the effort and exhaustion, the very journey itself, that opens the view which is everywhere. For the summit is not so much arrived at as we are worn open to it. I felt the truth of arriving at wherever my human limitations had left me, knew somehow it was enough, and I let out a cry like a vapor. We are as bare as these crags being worn by endless wind, and regardless of the maps we carefully draw and pass down, we arrive at what we've always had when we use up everything we've saved. In this way, we are brought to humility. Once accepting our frail humanity, we can see how stubbornly fragile living things are. We can see how it takes just a thin lick of water down a mountain crack to strengthen a root and a bare lick of love through our stony hearts to blossom a soul. Earlier, we asked these questions, which seemed worthwhile to explore again. So breathe deeply and see what they touch in you now. What is it about being human that you are most grateful for? What is it about being human that continues to surprise you? And from the same book, The Kinship of Gratitude. When you make the two one, when you make the inner as outer and the outer as inner, then shall you enter the kingdom, Jesus. The goal of all experience is to remove whatever might keep us from being whole. The things we learn through love and pain reduce our walls and bring our inner and outer life together, and all the while the friction of being alive erodes whatever impediments remain. But the simplest and deepest way to make who we are at one with the world is through the kinship of gratitude. Nothing brings the worlds of spirit and earth together more quickly. To be grateful means giving thanks for more than just the things we want, but also for the things that surmount our pride and stubbornness. Sometimes the things I've wanted and worked for, if I actually received them, would have crushed me. Sometimes just giving thanks for the mystery of it all brings everything and everyone closer, the way suction pulls streams of water together. So take a chance and openly give thanks, even if you're not sure what for, and feel the plenitude of all that is living brush up against your heart. Sit quietly and meditate on what keeps you from knowing yourself. Breathe deeply and lower your walls with an offering of gratitude that is not attached to any one thing. Now inhale with gratitude and exhale what remains in the way. Repeat this several times throughout your day. We turn now to the October issue of Science of Mind, Guide for Spiritual Living. And the theme that month was Pieces into Peace. And we turn to Reverend Jesse Jennings' monthly columns. And this first one is about feelings before the election, but I think it'll apply to feelings after the election as well. Questions and answers. Pick one problem at a time. Question. I can't seem to get past my feelings of impending doom, which are amplified by all the hateful rhetoric and divisiveness around the coming U.S. election. I know I should pray, but how? Answer. Our feelings are powerful teachers, so a healthy general approach is to sit and listen to them without judgment or revision. However, at times we need to push through our feelings. When they're so overwhelming that we can become engulfed and paralyzed by them, we must remember we can break in with some new conscious choices. You describe existential angst, the dread of life as it seems to be playing out. Your sense of this is legitimate, not meaning that your fears will necessarily be proven factually justified, but that you are entitled to have fears. So often we tend to make somebody or something wrong, especially, but secretly, ourselves, to muster up the resolve to take a stand and work for change. I wish you to know that you are not wrong for feeling as you do, not spiritually deficient, not an unbeliever. You are scared. Many are. Now, what can be done about that? I come back to a short list of what can be controlled in the here and now. We know we can't control other people's choices. We've been trying that since childhood. We can offer persuasive arguments if anybody's listening, but it's the self we control, one thought at a time. There are many troubles in the world today. Whether these are old or new troubles, how they compare in importance to one another, or who's to blame for them, all of this is beside the point. I say pick one problem at a time and try to envision its positive opposite. Then act in support of that unfolding reality in the ways you are inwardly directed. Notice how you feel moving forward and keep track of your own acts of kindness, civility, and generosity, and the difference they make by representing the kind of world you prefer to inhabit. The best way to pray. Question. I learned a 5-step technique of spiritual mind treatment, while I hear others learned a 7-step version. What's the difference, and which is better? Answer. Yes, while some heard about recognition, unification or identification, realization or affirmation, thanksgiving and release, others had 2 more steps inserted between realization and thanksgiving. Those extra steps were denial and reaffirmation. For the new reader, these steps begin with the recognition of a higher power that's fully present everywhere. Our identification with that power as the source of everything we are and do, an affirmation of some particular good we desire to experience. Thanksgiving for the fact that in our emotional field, in joyous expectancy, we are experiencing that good. and release of all the foregoing into the creative, subjective aspect of mind, the subconscious, which unites desires with their actualization. This is the religious science type of prayer. It's not the only type we ever use, but it forms the basis of our spiritual work. Our affirmations declare a new quality or condition as though it were materially present, now and here. Those extra two steps, denial and reaffirmation, can help in the event we're beset by doubts. We can deny that there is any opposing power to our word. Facts are what they are, and we may take them at face value like everybody else does, but there's a big difference between factual diagnosis and inevitable prognosis. Material laws are real, yet unseen energies and undiscovered principles swirl all around us. Anything can be overcome because anyone can change. Again, we're not exactly denying how things are, but we deny that anything requires them to remain that way. Then, with rekindled enthusiasm, we reaffirm that outcome we stated earlier with any emotional roadblocks from past disappointment or present confusion moved gently aside. Some also call this the argumentative form of treatment, in that we talk ourselves out of one position and into another. Is denial necessary? Not if we can accept our good right off the bat, which is something worth affirming. We turn now to the November-December issue of Spirituality and Health, a Unity publication, and Enlightened Perspectives, Sharon Salzberg Cultivates Loving Kindness by Karen Brailsford. As a world-renowned Buddhist meditation teacher and New York Times best-selling author, Sharon Salzberg has motivated thousands of people to find their own path to inner awareness. She began studying meditation in India in 1971, has been teaching internationally since 1974, and was a key player in bringing meditation practices into mainstream Western culture. Salzberg's one of the co-founders of the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, is known for her gentle, pragmatic perspective about the mundane as well as the momentous. Here, she talks with contributing editor Karen Brailsford about her adventures over the decades and reveals how we can meet this unprecedented moment in history with compassion, mindfulness, and loving kindness. Karen Brailsford: I love your Zoom profile photo. Simply meditate and carry on. Sharon Salzberg: Isn't it cool? KB: I did exactly that before jumping on this call. We're talking at an interesting time as the presidential election campaign is heating up. Just yesterday, you and American Buddhist scholar Robert Thurman held a workshop that ties into what's happening right now. Sharon: The workshop was based on a book we wrote together that came out 10 years ago. There's a new edition this year, and we also recorded an audio version. Love Your Enemies is really a fit for our time. The formulation is Tibetan Buddhism and came from Bob. It describes four kinds of enemies. Outer enemies are people who seek to harm us. Inner enemies show themselves when we're overcome and guided by anger and fear. Then there's the secret enemy, self-preoccupation or selfishness, which is this sense of a separate individual completely disconnected from itself that is in charge. And finally, there's the super-secret enemy, which is self-loathing and feeling unworthy. The teaching is to use the outer enemy to help you with the inner enemy. When you've got an adversary, someone trying to hurt you, use that as a spark for coming through your own anger and fear to another place. The other place is not weakness and giving in and saying it doesn't matter or that you don't count. It's finding other sources of strength because our anger is going to burn us out eventually. So that is not an effective way to actually make a difference. I teach loving kindness meditation, and people often say to me, "Why should I have loving kindness or compassion for the person who doesn't think people like me should exist?" It depends on our notion of what loving kindness and compassion are. If it means submitting and taking it, then it's ridiculous. Why get up in the morning to cultivate that? But if you see it as a source of strength, where your own self-worth is going to insist on boundaries, then that's a more correct interpretation of loving kindness. It was an incredible time to be teaching that particular topic. KB: Were people open and receptive to this idea? Sharon: It obviously a self-selecting group. If we were doing this in the middle of Times Square, I don't know how it would go. KB: Politically, have we seen this kind of chaos before? Sharon: I don't think so. I'm a giant advocate of voting because I believe everyone has a voice, and that voice should never be taken away from us. I've done voter registration. I don't tell people who to vote for, even though I have my own views, but I think that engagement, that participation, is absolutely essential. While different groups have historically been denied the right to vote, this is a time where several efforts, often in a sneaky kind of way, are in play. I do think that the very nature of democracy and what they call the American experiment is on the line. KB, I know of people fleeing to other countries, but I'm not so sure another country would be a safe haven. What's happening here has ramifications elsewhere. So for me, it becomes about anchoring and shifting the consciousness right where one is. Sharon, globally, there's clearly a lot going on. Somebody told me that more than 50 of the world's nations are having elections this year. As a meditator, I believe that ultimately one's sense of safety lies within, because there are no guarantees. We live in a very unsteady, unstable world. I think the years of isolation under COVID did not help our mental health and our level of fear and anxiety. Even before the pandemic, I kept reading that there was an epidemic of loneliness. I'd read about the healing effects of social connection and various clinical conditions. I kept thinking, it can't just be a numbers game. I have only 3 friends. I need 8. It's also about some inner sense of connection, of belonging to one another, of belonging to the whole, which seems to have really been disrupted. As for physically moving to another place, I resort to a loving-kindness prayer. May you find safety. KB, where are you right now? Sharon, I'm in Barre, Massachusetts. I have a house that's next door through the woods from the Insight Meditation Society, the retreat center I co-founded in 1976 with Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield. I also have a very small rental apartment in New York City. I was there in March of 2020. There was so much fear on the streets. I knew a lot of people whose parents were getting sick and dying. I thought I'd come here for 2 weeks and ride it out. I arrived around March 14th, and 3 days later, the center closed. I was here for 8 months before I left at all. I've only been to New York and back since then. I haven't been on an airplane. KB, I'm intrigued by the journey to India that set you on a lifelong inner journey. Where do you feel at home? Sharon, I grew up in New York City and went to college in Buffalo, New York, when I was 16. In my sophomore year, I took an Asian philosophy course because it was a philosophy requirement, and it fit nicely into my schedule. The course totally changed my life. I'd had a very traumatic childhood, and my family system, like for many people, was one that was never spoken about. I had all of these feelings roiling inside of me, and no external voice saying, "We understand," or "No wonder you feel that way." In the course, they were talking about the Buddha and how suffering is a natural part of life. For many people, that's kind of a depressing message. But for me, it felt like the first time in my life I really belonged. I thought, you're not so weird. You're not so different. It was this tremendous, even breathtaking message of inclusion. I learned about these practices called meditation, and that if you did them, you could be a whole lot happier. I was totally timid. But something came over me, and I thought, I've got to go to India to learn how to meditate. I was on fire. This was in 1969. I created an independent study project, and I went off to India. So, where do I feel at home? I feel at home in New York City. There's something about the rhythm of it. It's like my internal rhythm, as crazy as it is. I feel at home in Barre. This is the only place I've ever voted. I felt tremendously at home in India. When I landed, I thought, I'm breathing differently. This feels familiar in a strange way. This feels right. KB, you have been credited with bringing meditation to the West. Sharon, well, I don't believe we brought meditation to the West exactly. There have always been Asian practitioners and teachers here, but I think we did play a pivotal role in aspects of it hitting the mainstream. KB, how has meditation shifted in terms of what you were doing then and people's response to it? Sharon, when I came back to the States in 1974, I'd be at a party, and when people would ask, "What do you do?" and I said, "I teach meditation," they'd go, "That's sort of weird." Or they'd ask, "Did you ever meet the Beatles over there?" Now, when I'm introduced as a meditation teacher, they commonly say, "I should try that. I'm so stressed out." Partly because we have a much greater understanding of stress and its consequences, the conversation around meditation has moved from a belief system or a philosophy to science. Occasionally they say, "I tried it once. I failed at it. There's a lot of confusion about what progress looks like. For example, a lot of people will say, I'm really bad at meditation because I can't make my mind totally blank. I can't keep anxiety from arising. Mindfulness is a relational activity. It doesn't mean you don't have any thoughts. It means you may not be swept up in them, or you may not be fighting them and ashamed of them in the same old way. You develop a new relationship to your thoughts, your body, your sensations, your emotions. KB, has your own practice evolved? Sharon, yes, and it continues to evolve in different ways. The first instruction I received was in mindfulness, awareness of the breath, and then bodily sensations before moving on to thoughts and emotions. I started practicing in January 1971 in India. It was only in 1985 that I went to Burma on a three-month retreat and got formal instructions in loving-kindness meditation, which is a corresponding, supportive, but distant method that's become a predominant part of my practice. So that's one framework. Another framework is that there are a couple of ways we look at meditation. One is a formal, dedicated period of practice, like 10 or 20 minutes a day when you're sitting or you're walking, and you're devoting that time to deepening awareness and loving kindness. The other aspect of meditation is what one teacher once called short moments, many times. So you drink a cup of tea while you're not checking your email, and you're feeling the warmth of a teacup while smelling and tasting the tea. Or, as I'm walking down the street in New York, I often silently offer loving kindness to the people I pass. May you be happy. In the beginning, of course, everything for me was about that formal practice because I was learning it. It was so exciting. As time went on, I began to infuse meditation into my daily activity more. When I came back up to Bar in the beginning of the pandemic, I wasn't walking down the streets of New York anymore. Life really shifted, and I started doing a lot more formal practice during the day. KB, did you have an inkling as a child that you would embark on a spiritual path? Sharon, there was a voice I heard, even in my despair. I knew things could get better. I knew there was another kind of life waiting for me. How I knew, I don't know. I was numb. I was cut off. I was frightened. I guess I was depressed, although I was never diagnosed clinically. But I knew how to get through school. I knew how to survive. It may be that all children hear that voice, but they don't always listen or trust it. KB, we often call individuals heroic for overcoming obstacles, but I think we're meant to transcend circumstances. Even if you're born to a seemingly intact family, you have challenges. Meditation is an empowering way to handle them. Sharon, it has a lot of benefits. If I had to describe myself in one word before I went to India, it would be fragmented. What I yearned for, although I didn't have the word, was integration. I wanted to feel whole. A benefit of meditation is that sense of cohesiveness, of centeredness. Life is change. Meditation gives you a greater ability to ride the waves. Not that you don't enjoy the ups or feel sorrow with the downs, but maybe not to the annihilation of your being. And then there is a sense of connection. I always consider that one of the greatest ironies, because maybe you meditate alone, maybe you do it with your eyes closed, but it's not an isolating activity. You connect to so deeply to yourself, and you also feel so much more connected to others. I guess there's less fear, less old habit operating, and you really pay attention differently. So if you're in a conversation with somebody and you're not really listening, you gather your attention. It's what we do in meditation. And once you are paying attention, there's a possibility of some real sense of connection. KB, do you have a favorite among your books? Sharon, Faith is probably my favorite. It was the hardest to write, and I think it was honestly the best written. KB, in your works, you distill stories and poems and messages in a way that is uniquely Sharon Salzberg. And you've befriended and collaborated with a number of illustrious individuals, like Bob Thurman and Jack Kornfield, and feminist icon Bell Hooks. Sharon, I once received a negative review that I bring in too many voices, but those relationships, those friendships, are the biggest blessings of my life. KB, what do you fear? Sharon, I fear for the country. I fear massive suffering. I've had some real health crises in the last several years, and like many people, I fear being a burden to others. KB, what are you loving right now? Sharon. I wrote in one book how much the musical Hamilton meant to me, and I was thinking last night, in light of current events, maybe I should rewatch it. KB, who in history would you like to meet? Sharon, Deepa Ma, my teacher in India who told me to teach meditation in 1974. That's ridiculous. I can't do that, I told her. I'd like to see her again and say, well, it kind of worked out. Sharon Salzberg is a co-founder of the Barr Center for Buddhist Studies and the Insight Meditation Society. She is the author of 13 books, including New York Times bestseller Real Happiness, Loving Kindness, and 2023's Real Life and Finding Your Way. Recently, Salzberg has begun to record her books, giving voice to her meditations. She also hosts a podcast called The Meta Hour. Visit SharonSalzberg.com. SharonSalzberg.com. We turn now to the spring-summer issue of Light of Consciousness from 2023 and a column by Swamar Amar Jyoti, Parampara, Answers to Questions on the Spiritual Path. Would you say a few words about the relationship between relaxation, devotion, and longing after God? If the person is longing for God, can they relax about it? And I'll pause for a moment and say, please substitute for the word God whatever word or meaning feels better to you. God, Spirit, the universe, one power. All right. Longing is not restlessness or disturbance or misery. It comes from being very relaxed within. Let us differentiate between longing for God and longing for worldly things. When you long for God, your mundane urges or motives are transcended. The desires that keep you restless and impatient get straightened out. When you long for God, you truly relax. And when you're relaxed, your love for God grows. It is only because of disturbance of mind that we are not able to love God. Relax, and love of God will spring up in you all of a sudden. Relaxation leads you to one-pointedness, or put the other way, longing for God makes you one-pointed. Therefore, you relax, and love awakens. Is the purpose of prayer to purify and humble us? Yes, prayer should be for humility. You are asking something from the Lord of the universe, but he's not bound by our prayers. He will understand. Do not say that because you prayed to God, he should give what you ask. This ego trip has to be avoided. And often you've seen that what you ask for is not given. This is not because God did not listen. You may be praying with relatives and friends for someone who is very ill, yet God takes that soul away. Do your duty by loving, caring, bringing medicine, giving water, whatever is needed for that soul, but leave the results up to the Lord. That is the best prayer, for the Lord to do his will. If you cannot be so selfless, the second best is to pray, Lord, thy will be done, but have mercy upon me. When we're asking something from the Lord of the universe, let us be humble. Instantly our prayers will be heard. What does it mean to fulfill the purpose of human birth? Human birth is one of the levels of evolution, like animal, mineral, and vegetation. We sometimes call human birth a school, where we come to learn lessons. Compared to the lower species, man is more rational, intelligent, and therefore can inquire and seek. Lower species do not seek, at least not consciously. The importance of human birth is that our conscience and mind are given unto us to be open. We are active mentally as human beings, but to make the best of human life, we must use conscience. The day our conscience will be more dominant than our mind, we will have fulfilled the purpose of human birth. Is selfishness the same as suppressing one's true self? The word selfish includes self, just as true self includes self. Selfishness is simply being narrow. When you limit your purpose or motive to your ego, you are selfish. True self is unbound, so that whatever you do becomes selfless. When you suppress the true self, you are the limited self. And when you act from limitations, that is called selfishness or ignorance. When you act through your universal or unbound faculty, that is your true self. When you are selfish, you are not suppressing your true self entirely, but allowing only a little bit of your cosmic self to appear. So, selfishness is simply limited self. If your wishes are in tune with what should be, you are a realized soul. That is spontaneous living. We pause for a moment to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications, and you are currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. And if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info and audio/on demand. We continue now with Rainn Wilson's Soul Boom, Why We Need a Spiritual Revolution. And we are in Chapter 4, The Notorious G.O.D. And we pick up with a section on me and Wakan Tanka. You know, the 15th century philosopher Nicholas of Cusa had an indelible and unforgettable way of framing the conception of the Creator. He once said, "Divinity is in all things in such a way that all things are in divinity." He spoke of a God whose center, so to speak, is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere, kind of like Wakan Tanka, me in Wakan Tanka. So here I am in the 1990s in New York City in my turbulent adolescence, rebelling against most everything, including God. And isn't that what humanity is doing, really? Individuating in the midst of its collective turbulent adolescence? 8 billions of us pushing back against the perceived Father, God, the great big patriarch in the sky? I certainly was. But I was also searching for something. And it was during this fumbling stage that I stumbled on the concept of Wakan Tanka, which translates as the great mystery. When this gawky, confused, mid-90s soul rebel came upon this indigenous American idea of divinity, my mind opened like a sunflower. After all, I loved mysteries. Not of the Agatha Christie or true crime podcast variety, but of the mystical sort. I saw the making of art itself as a great mystery and was excited to dig into an even bigger one. My eyes were open to new possibilities as I read about this great spirit of the Lakota Sioux. I spoke a while back with the late Kevin Locke, a Lakota artist and elder, and consulted with him about what I had studied all those years ago. From my feeble understanding, this concept of Wakan Tanka is the creative force that binds and generates life. That exists beyond time and space. It is in no way anthropomorphic. Wakan Tanka is not a dude, being, entity, or demiurge. It is a mysterious power of the seven directions— north, south, east, west, up into the sky, down into the earth, and finally, the seventh direction, the internal, inside the chest, the heart, the soul. Wakan Tanka is the god of our ancestors and binds us to them and is experienced in connection to the wind, the sunlight, the grasslands, and the water. I came to understand that this loving power is completely and irrevocably welded to and within nature and cannot truly be understood as anything separate from the natural world. Consider this excerpt from a book that, in all honesty, I have not read, but I'm excited to quote. Rosalind Marie Armenta's The Earth Mysticism of the Native American Tribal Peoples, with special reference to the circle symbol and the Sioux dance rite. The mystical experience indigenous to the native North American tribal peoples stands out uniquely in the history of religions in that it is grounded in the vision of a sacred world which underlies, envelops, and is manifestly present within the entire empirical order. The sacred dimension, although being qualitatively different from the phenomenal realm, is not regarded as otherworldly or transcendently beyond in the same way as it is meant in a monotheistic or monistic apprehension of the divine. In this sense, the Native American does not transcend the world in the Christian or Vedantic or Neoplatonic manner. Rather, he plunges into the world and experiences himself and the earth with all its myriad phenomena as being totally immersed in and revelatory of the divine reality. All of the elements of creation, earth, air, fire, and water, all the animals and trees, all the humans, are extensions, aspects, dimensions, and reflections of this great mystery. In other words, the divine is within the world, not above the world. This is reflected in the well-known Lakota prayer of connection, Mitakayu Oyaisin, which translates to all my relations, or we are all related. Black Elk famously said, "The first piece, which is the most important," and that is P-E-A-C-E, is that which comes within the souls of people when they realize their relationship, their oneness with the universe and all its powers, and when they realize at the center of the universe dwells the Great Spirit, and that its center is really everywhere. It is within each one of us. Incredibly, similar to our old friend we quoted earlier, Nicholas of Cusa, remember? Whose center, so to speak, is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere. This concept pulses through many of the great indigenous spiritual beliefs, such as Gich Manitou, as the Great Spirit is known to the Algonquin, as well as the mystical all-encompassing power of Tetl in Aztec cosmology. There's a beautiful quote that sums up many of these thoughts, dictated in Onondaga by Chief John Arthur Gibson in 1912. This is a prayer revealed by the well-regarded Iroquois prophet Tekenawita, the great peacemaker. Now, therefore, we shall give thanks, that is, we shall thank the creator of the earth, that is, he who planted all kinds of weeds and all varieties of shrubs and all kinds of trees and springs, flowing water, such as rivers, and large bodies of water, such as lakes, and the sun that keeps moving by day and by night the moon, and where the sky is, the stars, which no one is able to count. Moreover, the way it is on earth in relation to which no one is able to tell the extent to which it is to their benefit, that is, the people whom he created and who will continue to live on earth. This, then, is the reason we thank him, the one with great power, the one who is the creator. To a wannabe shaman, a wannabe actor, artist, and a depressed, anxious, and sometimes lost young man who had jettisoned the faith of his childhood, this made sense. The idea of Wakan Tanka worked beautifully as a way in to reconceptualize God, the unknowable essence, the all that is, the originating mystery, the one, the universal mind, the timeless being. This discovery had many practical implications and tangible results for me. It slowly, eventually led me at the height of my mental health struggles to find a spiritual path toward greater peace, understanding, serenity, meaning, direction, and purpose. Because, at the end of the day, it all boiled down to what did the great mystery want from me personally? What does he want from us collectively? Surely there must be some kind of plan behind all this difficult, complicated beauty. Is there more at stake here than just seeking inner peace? If there is a higher power at work within, without, and beyond the forces of the natural world, what does this infinite, unknowable love, beauty, force have in store for us, individually and collectively? Surely it can't have created all of us, sad and beautiful human beings, and cast us on this planet like a bunch of ants in an ant farm to simply have at it, with a good luck pat on the back and a sign off of, hey, enjoy all this random useless beauty. There must be some kind of larger, all-encompassing spiritual vision at work for us humans. And since no network let me make a TV show about this notorious G.O.D., I guess you'll just have to continue to explore these ideas with me on these here pages of Soul Boom. Chapter 5. The Sacred Pilgrims. All this hurrying soon will be over. Only when we tarry do we touch the holy. Rainer Maria Rilke. A few years back, I visited Green Bay, Wisconsin, and as I emerged from its spotless, bland Midwestern airport, the beefy, mustached cab driver cheerily asked, like some character from Fargo, "You gonna go check out Lambeau Field? You don't want to miss it. Pretty much the only thing worth seeing around here." When I told him that I was attending a nearby arts festival, and then I was bummed to be missing out on the renowned local football stadium, he seemed mildly disappointed. "Well, maybe you can check it out on your way back. People come from all over the world, like a pilgrimage." We then continued our conversation about the Packers' chances, the weather, and the varieties of local bratwurst. But what he said got me pondering more about pilgrimages, about sacredness, and about holy spaces. Because, you see, my family and I had recently been on an actual religious pilgrimage to an actual holy site in Israel and returned a few weeks prior. As much as I appreciate Lambeau Field and many other football stadiums I've visited, and as much as I love the transcendent rush I experience when submerging myself in the outrageous communal emotion at a Seahawks game, this other pilgrimage was prompted by my religious faith and was inspired by something I believe to be holy, mysterious, and important. After all, the dictionary definition of a pilgrimage is a trip made to a holy place for religious reasons. Both my trip to Green Bay and the one to Israel got me thinking about what is holy in America in 2023 and about where we make pilgrimages to. Also, they got me thinking about what these old-fashioned words offer us at their deepest point of meaning and how desperately we human beings might need what the words point to. Note to the reader, up until this point, I know I've been all about the big stuff, pandemics, God, death. We're going to get to the other mega-doozy topic, religion, in short order. But for a few pages here, I'm going to interrupt your big ideas programming to wax philosophical about a simpler and subtler question. What is sacred? I'm going to shift gears and take a little detour by telling you a story of my travels and the profound effect they had on me. The themes and issues that I'll be laying out for you require more meditative pondering than any seeking of concrete answers. Think of the following as a kind of poetic contemplation on the sacred, the holy. The pilgrimage I made a few years ago to the holy place for religious reasons was incredibly special to me because underneath the soil of the shrine I visited is buried a prophet, the interred physical remains of a holy man whom I revere far more than even Green Bay Packers legends Brett Favre or Aaron Rodgers. The shrine is located outside of Acre or Akko, Israel, and it is called Bashi, or the Shrine of Bashi, pronounced Bazi, which translates to delight in Arabic. The name of the person who was laid to rest there is Mirza Hussein Ali, otherwise known by his title of Baha'u'llah, Glory of God in Arabic. I've mentioned him before. He was the founder of the Baha'i faith and someone whose work, example, and mission I study, follow, and deeply admire. Why was he buried there? Well, before Baha'u'llah passed away, he lived for many years in the small estate that is a stone's throw away from where he is now entombed. After being exiled from his native Persia in 1853 and living as a prisoner of the Ottoman Empire starting in 1863, he spent the last years of his life under house arrest there from 1879 until 1892. The pilgrims who visit this holy place are members of the Baha'i faith and come to this location in northern Israel from every corner of the globe. Among the almost 200 Baha'is visiting for our scheduled 9-day pilgrimage trip were believers from as far away as South Africa, Romania, and the Philippines. Thousands of tourists also come to visit the gardens and this particular sacred site as it is open to people of all faiths. I went with my wife, Holiday, also a Baha'i, and our teenage son, Walter, because we wanted him to experience sacredness on a visceral level that he would hopefully remember forever. We dressed nicely, not in formal wear or anything, but we didn't want to visit this most cherished spot in something like jeans, Crocs, or cargo shorts. We arrived by bus at the visitor center with several dozen other pilgrims and prepared ourselves for the long walk from there to the central grounds and buildings. The site of Bazi, which is several hundred acres large, is immaculately groomed with crushed red stone pathways that flow away from the central edifice in a star-like pattern. Numerous flitting hummingbirds swoop and spin around the verdant hedges and trees. A tall, beautiful wrought iron gate frames the entrance to the outer perimeter of the shrine area, a beautiful latticework that demarcates the sacred space on the other side and helps to give the grounds a distinct, sublime feeling. The pilgrim passes through those iron gates and approaches the outside of the stone shrine with an ever-blooming attitude of respect, head bowed, hushed, reverent. When we entered the area, we felt a change in the very air of the gardens. The scent of oranges and jasmine was profound. The air seemed to vibrate with a joyful feeling, joyful and still all at once. Even if you're not religious or don't consider yourself spiritual in the slightest, I can't imagine anyone approaching the grounds not having some kind of a sensation of awe or inspiration. In fact, I spoke to several visitors who were not Baha'i and who acknowledged that very fact. It's in the air. When we got to the entrance of the small stone building, the destination of our journey, we, along with everyone else, removed our shoes at a covered alcove outside the door that leads inside the shrine. I'm sorry to admit this, but I was extremely grateful my socks didn't have any holes in them. There's a small velvet box filled with prayer books in dozens of languages that folks from all over the world can use to say Baha'i prayers. Tradition asks that you enter the simple but ornate doors with a bowed head and to always be facing the specific area inside where this great divine teacher is buried, never turning one's back toward the actual point of adoration, as that would feel slightly disrespectful. Slowly, carefully, we entered the edifice itself, which is approximately 50 feet by 50 feet and was built well over 100 years ago, originally as a guest house. As we entered the main room, we saw a central alcove now roofed with glass skylights, like a greenhouse. The floors were covered in the most beautiful, overlapping antique silk and wool Persian carpets that you've ever seen. Well-tended plants, ferns, and flowers decorated the central area of the inner sanctum, and the vines reached toward the ceiling and the skylights, up toward the light, allowing the space to become both a beautiful conservatory garden as well as a sacred mausoleum. I found the room hushed and still, even when it had dozens of people inside, the muted crack of prayer beads, an occasional muffled sob, outside the intermittent caw of a far-off crow. A hint of sweet jasmine and incense in the air. There were a few small rooms that branch off from the central skylighted one, and in every room we saw visitors in all modes of dress from their native cultures, sitting or on their knees or prostrated, always facing the burial area, which was partitioned with a translucent curtain and illumined by a small lamp, under the floor of which Baha'u'llah was interred. I sat on the beautiful antique silk and wool rugs and prayed. Some of the prayers I read from a Baha'i prayer book, and some I recited from my heart. I said prayers for loved ones, prayers of praise and gratitude, prayers for help and assistance, and sometimes I would stop and just be still and silent for long, long stretches of time. And it should be noted that when I mention said a prayer, most of the time it was simply feeling a prayer, a generally beseeching kind of loving kindness and warmth in my heart. My mind was mostly quiet, tranquil. At times my heart was filled to bursting with emotion, joy, and exaltation, and then, as other times, I felt oddly removed. I may have wept. I can't remember. I can remember being very uncomfortable on the floor and adjusting my position a good deal, as my chubby middle-aged legs tend to fall asleep a lot. I also remember thinking to myself repeatedly, kind of like a giggly teenager, "Wow, I'm in one of the most sacred places in the world. Cool." But mostly, I was in a deeply extended place of reverence and peace among the ferns and vines and pilgrims and rugs and the aroma of holiness. I sat in that small sacred space for what I assumed to be about an hour, but could have easily been two or three. Time worked strangely in that place. It seemed to slip away and elude one's grasp for some reason. It didn't feel linear. Time felt somewhat elongated there, like molasses. It reminded me of times I had sat in a deep forest wilderness and was so transported in noticing the sounds and smells around me that I completely lost track of the clock. Before leaving, I pressed my forehead to the threshold of the corner of the shrine, where the veil to the inner sanctum was, and said a quick, humble prayer of thanks. When exiting the shrine, one backs away slowly, with reverence. This can be a little tricky, as there are three small stairs leading into the building, and walking backward down them can be a little challenging for the elderly, and people like me are prone to falling down at the most inopportune places and times. I pictured myself tumbling backward down those little stairs in front of all these reverential pilgrims like Jim Carrey from some 90s comedy, and springing back up. "All righty, then." Once we had respectfully backed away from the shrine a bit and turned our attention back to the surrounding gardens, I found that the world had shifted. It's like when you hit your windshield wipers and spritz the glass in front of you, and all of a sudden you realize just how dirty it had been. Just like that, you can see everything outside your car with a renewed clarity. It was like that, only in my heart. I saw the beautiful hedges and olive trees and birds in a new light. I felt renewed, tranquil, joyous, like something unseen had shifted. The eldest son of Baha'u'llah, Abdul Baha, who holds a very special station in the Baha'i faith, said of pilgrimage, "Holy places are undoubtedly centers of the outpouring of divine grace, because on entering the illumined sites associated with martyrs and holy souls, and by observing reverence, both physical and spiritual, one's heart is moved with great tenderness." Indeed, my heart, after just a small window of time in that precious sanctuary, was filled with a great tenderness, a tenderness that comes from repeated demonstrations and expressions of reverence, as well as a prolonged contemplative silence. The shrine of Baha'i is so sacred that for the high of the world, it is the point of adoration, the Qibla, the focus point that Baha'is turn to when they say their daily prayer. It is the point that Abdul Baha says is the luminous shrine around which circumambulate the concourse on high, a convocation of the holiest angels in heaven. Just as many Jews focus their rites toward the Temple Wall in Jerusalem, and Muslims perform their five times daily prayer facing the Kaaba, most holy spot, in Mecca, Baha'is from all over the world face this garden near Haifa in reverential daily devotion. While reciting the short obligatory prayer, Baha'is both physically and metaphorically turn their hearts to this exact geographic point at some point during the day. There's even a compass app that shows you exactly which direction to face. We say a short daily prayer that Baha'is believe reveals why we are alive, why we were created. Baha'u'llah writes in one sentence of this brief prayer, "I bear witness, O my God, that thou hast created me to know thee and to worship thee." Italics mine. It's really that simple. It all boils down to that. Our ultimate purpose is to know and worship the Creator. What that exactly means is the topic for another chapter or another book. And Baha'is, the world over, are reminded of this purpose on a daily basis as they turn, often from tens of thousands of miles away, toward this shrine that my family and I had just visited. In so many ways, this garden for me was the paragon of the sacred, so much so that in the days and weeks that followed my pilgrimage to the Baha'i Holy Lands in Israel, I kept tossing all these words and concepts around in my head, words that we don't examine much or really think about in our daily life, words that are almost entirely missing from everyday society and work, words like sacred, pilgrimage, holy, reverence, divine, blessed, devotion, sanctity, devout, prayer, prostration, worship, shrine. And the word that stood out to me most was sacred. No exploration of the spiritual journey would be complete without an examination of the sacred. It's a difficult word to define these days. What does it mean exactly? It exists somewhere on that master list of other truly difficult to define words like holy, blessed, divine. In the same category as other hard-to-define words like frittata, nonplussed, and socialism. When I asked my friends Merriam and Webster, I zeroed in on their second definition of the word as the one I'm most interested in. I am intrigued by this definition of sacred. A. Worthy of religious veneration. Holy. B. Entitled to reverence and respect. What is holy? What is worthy of veneration and reverence these days, especially in the chaos and static of the modern world? Where are our sacred shrines, worthy of a pilgrimage? Where are the devout, the devoted, the devotions among us? These seemingly archaic, outmoded words and questions that nobody really discusses in our unsacred or desacralized contemporary society, or that anyone thinks about in the dailiness of our lives. So, as I've recently experienced a sacred in my bones and body, I thought I would try to share some of my personal feelings and reflections, and perhaps in the doing, some meaning will gradually reveal itself. As I laid out in the previous chapters, I had a phase in my spiritual searching where I was deeply moved and transformed by Native American ideas around spirituality. At the risk of grossly overgeneralizing, in the Native American worldview, pretty much everything that exists is sacred, especially in nature. Black Elk once said, "Perhaps you have noticed that even in the slightest breeze you can hear the voice of the cottonwood tree. This, we understand, is its prayer to the Great Spirit, for not only men, but all things and all beings pray to him continually in different ways." Plants and animals have spirits that are considered as real as their actual bodies. Prayers were often said over animals whose lives were taken by the hunt and whose meat and skin were used for food and survival. Nearby mountains and lakes often have a spiritual uniqueness and are ascribed with legends based on actual history. Spirits thrived everywhere, and myths connected the divine world and the spirit world of one's ancestors with the natural, physical world at every turn. These concepts were in direct contrast to the teachings of the Christian clergy when they came to the American shores. Luther Standing Bear, 1868 to 1939, who had an incredible history, going from son of a chief to a Hollywood actor and stuntman, said of the sacredness of nature, "Only to the white man was nature a wilderness, and only to him was it infested with wild animals and savage people. To us, it was tame. Earth was bountiful, and we were surrounded with the blessings of the great mystery." This profound spiritual legacy of being surrounded with the blessings of the great mystery and viewing all living things as continually praying to the Great Spirit doesn't really fly these days. In fact, my life in 2023 Los Angeles is pretty much lacking in anything remotely sacred or spiritually connected. It's all iPhones, quickly devoured sandwiches, and leaf blowers. It's texts and podcasts and emails. It's pressured phone calls, calendars, and a nonstop news feed. Part of the issue in 2023 America is the enormous discrepancy between what is sacred to the conservative and liberal halves of our country. In this, as in pretty much everything else, we also seem to be divided. In a grotesquely gross generalization, that certainly does not apply to everyone on the right. To a conservative, the Bible and Constitution might be considered sanctified, the traditional idea of family, as well as a church and the cross that's inside that church. An unborn baby's life is also sacred, perhaps Jesus and how he is portrayed. The American flag, the nobility of the military. These are belief systems and viewpoints that arose from several centuries of a distinctly American Christian point of view and hold true for much of the heartland of our nation. Whereas to the more secular urban liberal, and again, this is a generalized portrayal of a belief framework, holiness is, at least from a religious consideration of the word, something that might, at its worst, be considered as a superstition. It's a term that is often viewed as being fabricated by either a mass religious imagination or the clergy of a specific religion that has some nefarious agenda, or as some holdover from an ancient belief system. Well, we will continue. Interesting place to stop, I know, but we'll continue with Rainn Wilson's Soul Boom in the coming weeks. I'm finding him, and I hope you are too, to be quite kind of a delicious author and one who presents things in a very serious but also very humorous manner. As always, I wish you a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week, and I very much look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher Program. Have a beautiful Thanksgiving holiday.